It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We turn to your requests seeking a deeper dive on global events and specifically Russia's invasion of Ukraine, now entering a third year. Thanks to Jerry in Kakana asking for a discussion about military aid from allies. And Tomas in Madison wants
more about the kind of changing geopolitical landscape and the need for a multipolar world, and how the United States specifically should be positioning itself in order to avoid getting sucked into World War III.
Colin with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ted Gerber is a sociology professor at UW-Madison and director of the Wisconsin-Russia Project. Ted, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
So let's start with Ukrainian forces retreating from the eastern city of Avdiivka and getting reports here the broader war has essentially been a stalemate. What is the significance of Ukraine retreating from a city?
Well, it's hard to assess the significance. I'll tell you there's sort of two perspectives on this. One is that it's actually unfortunate or quite detrimental to the Ukrainian cause because the Ukrainians now face the major crisis they face, in addition to some political crises, is shortage of manpower and ammunition. And the fear is that this victory that the Russians have in Avdiivka will be followed up with a continuing advance, and that it will really hurt Ukrainian morale. And it will be very difficult for the Ukrainians to continue to hold out or to hold out against further advances. So that's sort of the skeptical, very dire assessment. On the other hand, there are other well-informed analysts who argue that Avdiivka is not really a big deal. Strategically, it doesn't really represent a major asset to the Russians. If the Russians themselves are likely to be exhausted, they lost a mass number of casualties, massive amount of equipment, and so the more the less pessimistic, shall we say, assessment is that Avdiivka will not lead to further advances, but rather the Ukrainians will successfully dig in. A lot of it turns on, honestly, in my opinion, whether or not the American aid comes through that is currently still up in the air as a result of the House of Representatives failing to vote on it.
Yes, House Speaker Mike Johnson has yet to bring up the $95 billion package that would deliver military aid to Ukraine and Israel. So where does the Wisconsin House Conference stand on the bill, and where are the roadblocks right now?
Well, I think the Wisconsin House Conference is divided along, so far as we know, divided along party lines, although Representative Gallagher has stood out, who's recently announced he's not going to run for re-election. But he's also stood out as somebody who's been quite tough on Russia, sort of. I imagine if it does come up to a vote, Gallagher will probably vote yes. I don't, that's based on my assessment of his past practices. I agree with the many analysts who argue that if it is actually put to a floor vote, it will pass, and it will probably pass rather convincingly. I think the Democratic caucus is unified more or less in support of the package. There may be a few defectors because it includes aid to Israel as well. But the Republicans are fairly divided. The real issue is that the Speaker has refused so far to put the measure up for a vote. And there are various parliamentary techniques, discharge petition and so forth, that the Democrats and the Republican sympathizers with the bill may use. I think there's tremendous public pressure right now on the Speaker to bring this to a vote, and as there should be. I think the murder of Navalny by the Putin regime, Alexei Navalny, the long-term oppositionist in Russia, I think that only furthers the amount of pressure that Johnson is facing to step up to the plate and have an actual floor vote on this bill.
Ted Gerber with us, UW Madison sociology professor, focusing on Ukraine as we talk about the Russia-Ukraine war. You can join in with questions and comments along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ted, let's turn to Navalny's legacy as we saw the opposition leader Alexei Navalny dying in a Russian prison camp. What is Navalny's legacy?
Well, I mean, I think it is Navalny's legacy is to provide inspiration and hope to the many Russians who envision a different Russia than they've been offered under the Putin regime. The amount of courage he displayed, in fact, I think was one of the factors that actually got him ultimately killed. I think, you know, it's hard to think in world history of similar leaders, and by leaders, I don't necessarily mean leaders of countries, but leaders of movements, people who inspire others. And the fact that he returned to Russia, having already been almost poisoned to death, poisoned nearly to death, knowing full well what was going to happen to him, but nonetheless being committed to his cause and his purpose, which is a noble one, I think it really does inspire people worldwide. You see the reaction of world leaders. You see the reaction of Russians themselves, who those in the opposition in particular, who've had very little to cheer about. And so, of course, his death is tragic and sad. Of course, it's also been widely expected. And I think it makes people angry at this regime and what Putin stands for, which is murderous sort of revenge on anyone who dares to stand up to Putin's authority. And so I'm very optimistic that actually his death will inspire people to work harder, to fight harder, to continue to work for a better future for Russia than what Putin offers them.
But is there any way for the West to truly assess Putin's grip on power and the strength of the opposition who want that democratic future in that part of the world? How can you measure that?
You know, it's very difficult to measure. And there's actually, I would say, on the one hand, there's the conventional wisdom among that you read a lot about in the Western media coverage, which says that Putin is very strong, that he's been able to oppress most of the opposition, and that the war on Ukraine has helped him in that effort. It certainly seems, you know, by any objective measure, most of the opposition are really, even before the war, you know, there had been an effort. But since the war began, or since the full-scale invasion, I should say, began, Putin has really ramped up the crackdown. The opposition is weak. He seems to have he managed to deal with some internal dissent in the form of Prigozhin's mutiny. You know, Prigozhin, his erstwhile friend and a successful leader of the Wagner group of militants, carried out a mutinous march on Moscow, as it were, last summer in June. And Putin seemed to have dealt with that pretty well. So the conventional wisdom is he's in great shape. You know, the U.S., the West seems on their heels. Ukraine seems to be in retreat. But another perspective is that actually this is a very thin veneer that Putin has been, although he projects a sense of power, we don't really know what the vast majority of Russians think. And, you know, historically, we've seen in many authoritarian regimes, there appears to be a broad public support or at least acquiescence to the authoritarian system. But very suddenly that can turn. So, you know, when the Soviet Union collapsed, up until the very last moment, nobody could possibly imagine it would collapse. And yet then when it collapsed, everybody produced analyses showing that its collapse was inevitable. We could be looking at the same situation in Russia, and we just don't know. I don't believe the opinion surveys that are conducted in Russia. If you look at some other indicators, Russia's not doing so well. It's lost a lot of human capital. Its economy has managed to weather the storm of the sanctions, but it has aspects that suggest it's going to be completely unsustainable. So, for example, you know, imports of high-tech goods are way down, and they can put bandages on broken oil pipes and things like that for a while, but there's a cumulative effect of that lack of access to technology that are really going to hinder the Russian economy moving forward. So I think personally, actually, Putin is not in his in such great a position as many observers seem to think he is.
That analysis by UW-Madison sociologist Ted Gerber with us, who directs the Wisconsin-Russia Project, as we discuss world alliances and Russia's war against Ukraine. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the trajectory of the Russia-Ukraine war entering a third year and what this conflict means to Americans and Wisconsinites who are thousands of miles from Kyiv. Be part of this discussion. Call in with a question. Add comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ted Gerber is a sociology professor at UW-Madison and directs the Wisconsin-Russia Project. Let's bring in Jeff in Delafield. Jeff, hi, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Just wanted to relay two very interesting conversations I had recently, one with a former Romanian citizen, one with, I think it was a dual citizenship Russian from Moscow, and neither one knew each other. But what was so interesting was how their perspectives were very similar in that these Eastern Bloc countries, Russia, really suffered after the ending of the Cold War. What happened, apparently, is that all these factories, businesses were kind of turned over to an elite group of oligarchs, whatever you want to call them. And it was kind of a free-for-all for these people to basically take over all the resources of the country. The people suffered, and they kind of longed for what was formerly communism, authoritarian rule, and that's what they feel Putin is bringing back, and that's why I think Putin is maybe in a stronger position than what people realize. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Ted, go ahead.
Well, yes, I mean that is certainly true that many Russians, as well as citizens of other countries in the former Soviet bloc, suffered economically in the 1990s after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the similar regimes which the Soviet Union backed in Eastern Europe. And it's also true that the politicians like Putin have made a career out of playing upon the sort of lingering economic resentment, the nostalgia for the good old days where things seem secure. However, you know, reality is, of course, much more complicated. And a lot of that kind of perspective that first of all, it's one-sided. There are many people who did benefit from the changes following the Soviet collapse. There was very uneven the sorts of economic problems. And most countries of Eastern Europe, such as Poland, the Czech Republic, the Baltic Republics, they actually have thriving economies. So they experienced a period of crisis in the 90s, but since then they've been really taking off. Russia has been somewhat exceptional in this regard. Russia did have a decade of economic growth. It was very impressive in the 2000s when Putin first came to office, and it was driven largely by the export of oil and natural gas, which continues to be the major source of economic growth and performance in Russia. However, arguably, it was the Putin regime's own tendency to abscond with large sums of the wealth that was generated by Russia's exports that is to blame for the fact that many Russians still live in a relatively impoverished state, that the average earnings in Russia, people should know, are somewhere between $600 a month. Hmm. And so, that's obviously, imagine trying to get by on $600 a month. Perhaps some of your listeners do, but it's very difficult. And so Russia is not a thriving society, and Putin blames the collapse of the Soviet Union, where, in fact, Putin's policies themselves have contributed tremendously, probably the single most important factor, to the fact that Russia's economy is not thriving. And yet, so one way to understand this war that he's launched against Ukraine is that, in fact, it serves to distract his population from the fact that it's his government policies that are largely responsible for the failure of Russian standards of living to improve. Instead, he blames some kind of mysterious conspiracy in the West and launches a war in order to justify his arguments along these lines.
I want to ask, though, if Russia's economy continues to stagnate or cannot adapt, cannot move away from fossil fuels as the world tries to do so, will Putin be able to finance his war, or will he have to rely more and more on other authoritarian regimes in the world?
Well, I think the latter is the case. I don't think he will be able to continue to finance the war. I think, and so, of course, he's not going to say that. Of course, the Russians argue, look, we are strong. We have all these resources. We have a strong ally in China. We have strong allies in countries like North Korea, Iran, Venezuela. I mean, if you're looking for a sort of cabal of international pariah states from the perspective of the West, Putin also argues they have allies in the so-called global South. The countries in, developing countries, rising powers like South Africa have been quite sympathetic with Putin. But you're absolutely right that the internal dynamics of the Russian economy are very unfavorable. In the long run, wars and military technology and military power is based on economic power. You need money to produce weapons, to innovate, to come up with technological improvements. One thing the war showed us is that Russia has really not modernized its military quite as effectively, or not nearly as effectively, as they've claimed to have done in recent years. The weaponry competition really favors the Western weapons. When the Ukrainians have been armed, they've been quite effective at throwing back the Russia assault. They've been quite innovative. We don't see that kind of spark coming out of Russia. And in fact, if anything, the war is going to make it even harder. When they're losing their human capital, the young people with high levels of education have been leaving Russia in droves. The long-term and even the medium-term economic future of Russia looks quite grim. And so it really will turn on whether the West is able to maintain its solidarity and to keep up its support of Ukraine. And if it does, I think most likely, no one can really predict the future, but I think most likely Russia will be ground down and will not be able to sustain this war effort for the years that it seems to envision, or at least want us to think it's willing to do. So I think you're absolutely right that the economic situation in Russia is going to make it hard for it to continue its current policies, so long as it is not victorious. Now, if Russia wins the war, that will change the dynamic and it'll allow Russia the chance to retool, to step back, to consolidate its gains, and then to press further, which I think it probably will if it does win this war.
Talking with Ted Gerber, UW-Madison sociology professor who focuses on Ukraine as we discuss the Russia-Ukraine war entering a third year. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Turning to Ukrainians, how is this prolonged war affecting Ukrainian citizens?
Well, it's been quite devastating and extremely painful. So Ukraine has lost huge swaths of its territory. It's lost a major chunk of its population, both population that lives. There's estimated some 5 million Ukrainians living in the territories currently occupied by Russia. There's another 5 million Ukrainians who have been deported or voluntarily left those territories for Russia. There's probably some 7 to 8 million Ukrainians who have left Ukraine and fled as refugees to Europe. Right now, I think the Ukrainians have been displayed remarkable resilience, remarkable strength, remarkable national unity up to this point. But there are signs that may be starting to crack. I mean, any people who has to endure what Ukraine has in the last 2 years, these, constant bombardments from Russian missiles and drones, many of them supplied by Iran, on civilian targets, the loss of their husbands, fathers, sons at the front, the economic devastation wrought by the nature of war. We are starting to see signs of dissent within Ukraine. That Ukraine's one of its big problems now is a shortage of manpower for the front. It's having a lot of trouble figuring out ways to mobilize more men to go and serve in the military. I think right now morale is probably pretty low in Russia. We've seen the removal of the commander of the Ukrainian armed forces recently by the president. There's discussions within Ukraine itself. There are increasingly grumblings about the policies of President Zelensky. I think the situation is indeed pretty dire.
Ted, thank you so much for joining us and for the update.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ted Gerber is a sociology professor at UW-Madison and director of the Wisconsin-Russia Project. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.